Rabbi Chaim Blavinder discussing art and Jewish education with the Yatzit Fellows, Monday, March 14th, 2005.
Oh, good evening. My specific objective is to talk about how art might be used within the context of the spiritual development of a student. Now, spiritual development is itself a difficult topic to talk about. And even though everybody who teaches Torah probably feels he or she knows a lot about it, about the subject, this may not always be the case. So what I will talk about is a particular problem that we have, and the way that I think we might move in the direction of solving it. That particular problem has to do with tefillah, has to do with prayer. Davening is a word I like. Davening. I don't like the other words so much. We know that this is a very difficult subject to teach. Partially because I think many of us have given up and have accepted the fact that to daven means to go through some formal activity which has a beginning and a middle and an end, and that for some reason it's worth it. I mean, this reason may not be spiritual, but it may be communal, social, and for some reason it's worth it to daven. This generally doesn't work with kids who are interested in meaning and things that are meaningful. And so it's hard to convince children in a school, for example, that they should daven. Because you have to understand, I mean, I think that many of these kids, even if they come from religious homes of one kind or another, it doesn't really matter what kind it is, have never actually seen anybody daven. I mean, they may have gone to shul, but that probably only convinced them that nobody davens. Because the things that go on in shul are often nothing to do with davening. They have to do with things that adults like to deal with, like jostling for position, talking about what's happening, kind of communicating with people that I haven't seen for a week or even for a day, I mean, it doesn't matter, making sure that the end of it is at the preordained time, getting very annoyed if that preordained time is not actually maintained. So the kids, even small children, I think, who are not so stupid, and certainly can understand the difference between a major spiritual experience and a clubhouse, understand that the big people don't daven. And therefore, they get annoyed when they go to school and everybody is yelling at them that they're not davening well enough and that they should daven better. They don't really understand what the teachers want from them, because the teachers who are acting as policemen, they are also not davening. I mean, they are acting like policemen. So the kids who can understand the basic difference between davening, even though they've never seen anybody do it, but they know that walking around the room saying quiet is not davening. It's not in the sitter any place. In America, and some places in Israel as well, but the position of rabbi is not so well developed. You know, in America, the rabbi is usually like the head counselor of an unruly lunch. And therefore, the rabbi often, within the halachic constraints that exist, stands up in the middle of davening and tells everybody, be quiet. And there's no doubt in anybody's mind that when he does that, when he tells me to be quiet because if I talk I'm not davening, He's also not davening when he tells me to be quiet. So that the devil, the poor kid, who is watching all this go on, you know, who is used to watching things because he watches television and he knows about adults and sitcoms and all that kind of business. So he realizes early on that this whole thing is a fake. This is a very sad development, and not one that is easily remedied. I don't think that I have a remedy for this problem. As I said in the beginning, people usually learn how to daven by watching other people who are confident at davening. And it's a great schus, like it's a merit for somebody to be able to find somebody like that to look at. I would say that in general, I think, from my experience, my limited, narrow, humble experience, and everybody can disagree, I've not done a major or even a minor sociological test. In general, I think that women know how to daven better than men. I don't attribute this to a genetic aberration. I don't know anything about that. But I think about how women are different than men. I mean, I know that physically women are different than men. I know all of that. But I don't know how spiritually women are different than men. But women have a tremendous advantage because up to now, up to modern times, they didn't go to shul. And they had to daven at home. And when you daven at home, there's no one to fool. There's nothing else to do except, so either you daven or you don't daven, right? So women, because they were disenfranchised from the sacred and hallowed synagogue halls, you know, and were stuck on the roadside of the mechitza when they came and didn't know where the davening, where they were up to, and didn't realize that this was a great blessing. Because the other option was to be involved in whatever's going on in shul. And what's going on in shul is politics of one kind or another. But again, if you're home and daven by yourself, you have to generate a little bit of davening energy, right? A little bit. I mean, and sometimes it really works. It really works. So the whole business is a little cockeyed to my mind. That's the end of the introduction part one. Introduction part two is, how is it possible to develop in a student a feeling, a self-awareness that he has a spiritual capacity? I mean, how is it possible? How do you do that? Well, the way they try to do it today is by getting a few people to play the guitar during davening, and have all the kids stamp their feet or flap up and down and say, wow, you know, Amore is a real cool guy, you know, because he can also play the same kind of music that I would listen to. So this is true that it accomplishes the purpose of convincing the children that their teacher is also a child, which has limited value. Because when the teacher wants to convince this guy who is a child, right, who is an adult but a child, who can play the bongo drums or shoot hoops in the basket or something, do all the things that children do. So when that teacher or she, right, because the women could do all the same things, right, they also can shoot the basket into the hoop, and they can also play the guitar, so they do exactly the same thing. So, and they're all teenagers, because they all do it like teenagers. They're not guitarists, right? They're not classical guitarists. They play the guitar like Shlomo Carbach played the guitar. He didn't know how to play the guitar, right? They play basketball like the kids all play basketball. They don't know how to play basketball, really, right? So that they're all kids together. So when the teacher comes and says something like, Torah min HaShamayim, well, that's what he says. So the kids say, it's like a friend of theirs saying Torah min HaShamayim. There's no feeling that you can't generate a respect for the authority of the position. Like, you can't even think he really believes it. You know, he really believes, because he's like one of us. He's any of them, right? All the teachers and all the students are exactly the same. They're all part of the same team. Okay, the teacher has a certain authority on the bus that is going on the trip. You know, the teacher like can tell the bus driver to stop, and the kid can't tell the bus driver to stop. But that's not enough. That's enough, not enough to convince a kid of being very serious. So the question is, how can you? I mean, already I think given the answer, the way that you can teach children that there are serious things in the world is to present them with serious things, and to have the presenter of those serious things be very serious about it. This is not a formula. It's not what I'm not saying it's going to work. Well, it's not going to work, but this is the way you do it. How a particular teacher will exercise this responsibility is a difficult question. It's not something the teachers learn about. It's not the material that they're taught to teach. It has something to do with personality, with human development, not personality development, but with human development, somebody being able to find within themselves something that might be there. Well, this is a very hard job. It's not in the curriculum. The principal doesn't care about it. The school doesn't care about it. All they want you to do is finish chomer, and they want you to do mivchanim, and they want you to prove that you're a clever little Jewish kid, and to do this with the minimum of spiritual involvement. This is a problem. Now, I, in my own personal life, in my own personal life, I've discovered there are certain things that you might be in awe of. You know, certain kinds of experiences that make you feel different than other experiences, right? Everybody knows sunsets are special. Not every sunset. But some sunsets, even sunsets here in Eretz Yisrael, even in Yerushalayim, sometimes a sunset makes you feel special. In the article I wrote, I mentioned the Scottish Highlands several times. The Scottish Highlands are not like the Galil HaTachton. Even though the Galil HaTachton is very nice, and it's sometimes even green, sometimes, but it's not like the Scottish Highlands. It's true. I don't really understand why the Rabbanu Shalom put the Scottish Highlands in Scotland and didn't put them someplace near Beersheba. I don't know. But that's the way it is. There are things in the world which sort of like are astounding. They're not just big or nice or deep or high, but they are absolutely, absolutely astounding. Before I came on Aliyah in 1965, which was a long time ago, I went on a tiyul around America with an Israeli couple. But I was an American, but I thought that you drive and you... So I didn't know what going with Israelis meant. But then I found out that it meant that in 10 days you drive 6,000 miles. You get to any place, you take two pictures, and you get back in the car, and you run on. And then when you come back to... you come back to Israel, you invite all your friends to see the Tmunot. In those days, it wasn't so fancy. They just had pictures. So you go and you look. Okay, Ayinu Po. You don't say you were here for 30 minutes and you were there for 3 minutes. That was it to you. You had to get to every place and you had to see everything. So every place we got to, I had never been in Israel before I came in Aliyah. I never visited and I was never a student here. I just came. I came in Aliyah because I thought I had been brainwashed into thinking that was the right thing to do. So what difference would it make if I had been there before or hadn't been there before, if it was the right thing to do? So I went. I went to Aliyah. So we went on this tiyul, my wife and myself and this couple. Any place we went, I'd never been to Israel, we would say, Azay Islamabad, Zaya Mahdesha Katar, Zaya Mahdesha Katar, Zaya Gandhi, every place we went until we came to the Grand Canyon. We stood at the top and looked out at the Colorado River, and even this fellow said, Zotaut. He said, Zehilat. So there are things that you see that are absolutely showstoppers, and they engender special kinds of feelings. And I think that you have to find those things. You have to find a way of communicating to children, to students, that they have the capacity to have special feelings about things, and that those special feelings might be, not necessarily, but might be related to the fact that the world is created in a certain way and enables us to have those feelings. So one of the areas, this is not a promo for learning art, I happen to have an interest, I'm not sure why, I have an interest in art, and I spent a lot of time over many years going to museums, right? And I'd like to kind of share with you what an interest in art, how an interest in art might be effective as a tool for engendering this kind of feeling, which you can't do every day. You can't tell everybody to the Scottish Highlands every day or to the Grand Canyon every day, but in developing in children, in students, the feeling that they have the capacity to feel beyond what they can think. That somehow thinking can be sometimes a prelude to an exceptional feeling and experience, and that's what I'd like to talk about today. So what we decided to do is show a few minutes of a Sister Wendy video. Sister Wendy is a Catholic nun. I don't hold it against her. She doesn't know any better. And a very interesting person who became interested in art. I guess when you're a nun, you have a lot of free time. I'm not sure exactly. And she studied art from books, and people would send her postcards of different paintings. She had never really seen them, and she developed a language in which she's able to discuss her love of art and love of God in the same breath. Now, she was interviewed in a very famous interview for television by Bill Moyers, who is a guy with a somewhat southern accent, which, you know, since I'm from New York, automatically prejudice me against him, right? Because from New York, you can't imagine that somebody who speaks with a southern accent could really know what's going on, but he seems to really know what's going on, nonetheless. And I'd like to sort of, what I'd like to do tonight is, everybody will watch a few minutes of the Sister Wendy video, after which we're going to talk about a particular painting, okay?
It's very difficult to do because our eyes are not innocent. But we must help to make them so. We must perfume labels and prejudices. Just try to see as Charles sees.
But Charles sees that.
And Charles sees innocent here. Charles sees what's there. It doesn't see the labels and prejudices because it doesn't know about it. It just knows there's a thing. But of course the child hasn't got the capacity to respond at great depth to the thing, but we have. So we try to get the look of the child that sees what's really there, and the response of the adult that sees from the depth of experience that they're fortunate, and words in which to make that experience audible for other people.
I'm willing to surrender, but how do I train my eye to look?
You train it by doing it. How do you learn to pray? By praying. How do you learn to look? By looking.
Well, I see your heart.
Looking and waiting and going away. And coming back and looking and waiting. And if you've done that with sufficient illness, and nothing happens. No flowering within me. No sudden understanding that this is something magical and mysterious that you would are now in contact with, and that you do to mend me. Try again in 3 years' time. Go to another one.
What does this art come to, other than Matthew Love?
Well, I suppose it's given me enormous joy. It's also increased my capacity to accept darkness and pain and not be too bewildered by them. It's, I hope, made me a more sensitive and more alert person. The one fatal thing to be a zombie. And I think we're all in danger of living part of our lives at zombie level. But I think art helps one be perpetually there, as it were.
There it is.
There, alert, constant, zombie. Yes, in the moment. Because they come in every moment. We're not feeling those nerves, we're not even noticing that he's coming. We're drifting through. When you think in art you can't just clip, art is demanding of you attention. And I would hope that it helps me to be a more attentive person all the way.
You said that it helps you to see into darkness and sorrow. Does art sometimes tell us things we don't want to know?
Yes. I think that's very true. That's why I don't like saying art gives one great pleasure. But it does, but it gives one great pain too.
This is the whole art that really draws you in the deeply added to the spirit.
Yes.
In no sense.
Because it's going to deepen our awareness of the things that matter. It's going to make us, to the first what we did earlier, more a person of integrity, more true to my own essence than I would have been without this encounter. It's like meeting a great genius, talking, even being in the presence of such a person. You feel enriched, enlightened. You're more than you were before you had that encounter. Well, that's what painting is a piece of art in us. Encounters of greatness.
Is religious art synonymous with spiritual?
No, not at all. Religious art can be spiritual, but can be very dull. Religious art works on an iconography, and it works to the extent you believe in it. If you believe in this image, then the image will remind you of your faith and will have a religious effect. Yes, yes. A spirit of art will take you further than you really believe. It will take you into uncharted realms. The spiritual power is this ability to lift us out of the confines of our ego, out of the traps that many people are in. Relationships, their jobs, their worries, marriages, health. And there they go round in the age. And art opens the door, takes you into something bigger than yourself, something immensely exhilarating and refreshing. So when you come back into your cave, you know that's not all there is to life. You know, James Clark used to say, whenever you go deeply depressed, he you go and look at something, some great work of art. And there it was, sailing to the French Isles. Isn't it his word, isn't my word? Untouched by all our littleness and our anxieties. And we're taken into that, not as an escape, but as a way of coming back into our anxieties, more able to put them into perspective. Art is a great means of getting perspective of all that worrying, depressing, constricting in your life.
What did you mean when you wrote all great art is spiritual? Here, but not all great art is sacred. There's a distinction between the spiritual and the sacred?
Yes. Sacred, I think, is deeper. Sacred is spiritual at its most profound and emphatic. Sacred, I think, is spiritual after you know it's spiritual. There's a lot of spiritual art you don't know. Your spirit knows, but you don't know, you're just lacking in it.
Well, what did you mean when you said that sacred art is the most intense communication of personal truth?
Because it's the artist's personal truth confronting your personal truth. It is great art, it is sacred art. The artist is managed to put their entire truth there in those images. And your truth encounters them to the extent in which you allow it. And so you return to yourself enriched by encounter with the master's vision. Truth is what you're meant to be, but haven't yet perhaps become. Truth is what God made you to be. All your qualities fulfilled. No dead sections that you were afraid to work with change. No areas of negligence that you just didn't bother to take seriously.
Famous the picture. By that, I suppose I mean that even people who only know a little bit about art probably have heard of this painting. It hangs in the National Gallery, and last Friday afternoon, I went to the National Gallery.
In London?
In London, the National Gallery in London. And I looked at the picture is very big picture, it sort of takes up a lot of space. And I thought, and actually there was a lecture that was given by a woman with a very heavy Scottish accent about this picture that I stayed to listen to, but I didn't really understand what she was saying, even though it was in English. I mean, the one out of three words that I heard and understood. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about this picture. Now, one of the things that you heard it on the video at the beginning was that Sister Wendy argues that you can look at the picture with innocence. Now, today, when someone who has studied the history of art, or art history, whatever they call it in a particular place, doesn't look at the picture with innocence at all. But I'll just give you some ideas or some kind of notion of what the type of topics that scholarship is interested in when they look at this picture. Well, firstly, I mean, you don't mind if I don't ask you to tell me what you think they are. Is that all right? I'm just going to tell you myself. Firstly, the people in the painting look like simple people. And you know that painting went through stages. You know, early on, people painted heroic figures. like mythological or biblical characters, and they're always big and strong and had a lot of muscles and were always doing amazing things. Then later on, especially this portraiture, some kind of portraiture developed in England, where they liked to paint the Duke of this and the Earl of that, and they would always be dressed up in their finest, you know, lots of clothes. I mean, these pictures are very interesting if you want to know about 18th century haberdashery, you know, and the kinds of clothes that women might have worn. Like, all of these pictures are very, very tsanua, right? Both the men and the women very, very, like, they wear their entire wardrobe all the time. I don't know exactly how they do it. And the painter was very interested in presenting wardrobe. Here, in the Impressionists, I mean, you probably know what Impressionist painting is, but the Impressionists changed the subject matter. And they started painting regular things. They painted a riverbank, people going to swim, you know, like a regular kind of thing. It wasn't the Duke of, or the Earl of, or the Duchess going to swim, which would be really quite a production, but it was just people, working class people, who went for a swim. You could see that they don't look particularly impressive. You know, two of these guys are wearing Kova Tumble, which is certainly not impressive particularly. So that in the discussion of the history of art, one thing that they might be interested in is, when did they start painting a picture of this type against painting a picture of another type? A second kind of discussion that the historians of art might have is about explaining about the structure of the painting. I don't know if this is true, but this is what they say, that this guy is apparently important, right? He's a bigger, and he's in sort of like the front of the picture, catches your eye. But if you drew two lines, like in the rectangle, you'd find that he wasn't sitting exactly in the middle, but he was a little bit over to the right. And if you drew another line through his head, if you drew one line this way and another line through his head, you'd find that the distance from here to there against the distance from here to here in some proportions is the same as the distance from here to here and the distance from there. And now, historians of art love that kind of thing because I know, it makes them feel good that they can say something about it, right? This is all has to do with the lack of innocence. Also, a historian of art will tell you that there are a lot of triangles in this picture. You see triangles? You see triangles, like, see that boat? Thank you very much. There's a triangle. There's another triangle. Now once you get obsessed with triangles, you could find them maybe in the clouds someplace. You could find them, you know, with different people. Right, so triangles. What does that mean? I don't actually know, but maybe triangles make you feel good. I don't know. So this is the second thing that the historians of art might be interested in. A third thing is the methodology, right? Methodology. You know, pointillism, the impressionists, this trick where they would paint with dots, and they would take prime colors and dot, you know, a little something else. And so if you looked at it very close, what's happening? If you looked at the painting very close, it looks like, and I have also in the Museum of Israel, I think there are Pizarros, they have some Pizarros Museum show that are also painted in this method. You look at very close, you see dots, and you look at far away, it seems like it's a it's smooth. It seems like it's a smooth thing. So that the type of questions that the historians of art talk about are the types of questions that I mentioned. They might also be interested in history, like what happened at the time, what happened to get Impressionist painters to paint regular people, like what happened? Was it the French Revolution? Was it novel ideas of social equality? Painters are often considered to be avant-garde type of people. They don't have so much allegiance to the political system. So that's also always an interesting topic. But my feeling is that Sister Wendy has a point. And that point is that you can look at a painting with innocence, without knowing everything there is to know about the painting, although I wouldn't say that knowing more about the painting will put you necessarily at a disadvantage. I wouldn't say that. But I'm just saying that even if you had to show a child a painting, and you have to tell about the French Revolution, and about the upper classes and the lower classes, and the animosity, and that these people are making a statement by going swimming, and you just go and take a child to appreciate something. So I think that the adult has to appreciate it in a way that the child will be able to appreciate it as well. Right? So now, if you look at the picture, What is it that's striking about it? What is it that's striking? Is there anything? I mean, these people are not interesting. The distribution of people, I mean, I could talk about it perhaps, but I don't know if it's so interesting. The guy was in the water, he left his clothing over here, that was the boat. The other two people are sitting there, either going into the water, getting out of the water. There's a guy over there, further in the back. Huh? I mean, is there anything about this painting that innocently, now you can answer, that with all the innocence that you can muster, that is interesting, that's worthy, that might bring you back a second time? Like she said, is there anything here? I mean, you could also learn, while you're thinking, there's also the history of the painting. This is a painting that the artist painted over. He fixed it, at a later date, so you can learn about that. And he fixed the hats. He made them more, whatever they are, orange or reddish. All this kind of stuff, all this information floating around, which to my mind, if you don't have sensitivity to what it's about, it doesn't really matter. What is the most striking thing about the picture? Like, well, it could be different things. So you want to take a chance. Right, Holyoke. You see these people here? Asuk ba'atzmo, ani lo batuch. So that could be. I mean, lo batuch shezeh hamatzav. Ein ba'atzmo. But yesh od inyan. Pachot or yoter hem mistaklim l'oto makom. זאת אומרת, הגיבורים, 1, 2, 3, אולי גם 4, okay? מסתכלים לאותו מקום. And that place that they're looking at is not something that we're aware of. And the artists did not help us. I don't know what they're looking at. What catches their attention. Which catches their attention. In other words, in this very relaxed atmosphere where they're sort of not doing anything, they're not working, they're not planning, they're not building, they're not creating, they're not doing anything. They're not doing anything. This is a, well, this is a moment of rest, of mimucha, somehow. They're not doing anything, but there's something that holds their attention, something that keeps them, there's a certain humanity here. There's something that they're all interested in. And when there's something they're all interested in, I mean, there's a commonality, there's some sort of commonality of humanity. The dog, not exactly. The dog has been a subject of some dispute, but maybe you could say that. Did you see the dog?
No, it could be. You could say that they're all just kind of, they're at the beach, and they're all just staring out into space. But dogs don't do that. That dog is very alert. That's the look of an alert dog.
What about the people on the boat? Can you see the people on the boat in your copy here? I mean, the painting is much bigger, so you can see the people on the boat more easily. Where are they looking? Huh?
One is looking the other way.
Certainly. One is certainly looking the other way. What?
How many people on the boat? There seems to be a flag. That's not a person. It's another. One's looking one way, one's looking the other way. Seems to be a flag.
Well, but now you can't tell where they're looking.
He's got a goal and he's looking forward.
He's not looking the same way they're looking, right? In other words, there are people in the foreground. People, big people in the foreground who know something, and people in the background who don't. Right? And the people in the foreground who know something are for the artist, they are more important. And the people in the foreground are very, like the righteous people, or like Olam Mechava, Achra Chait. But they don't have all that junk, the clothing. That makes you, that says, you know, I am something because I dress this way. They don't have that. And the people on the boat do have that. And they're way, way off in the distance. They're way, way off in the distance. So I think that, you see that, did you see the picture again? Sorry. Oh. You see, like who knows something? These guys, they know something, right? They're totally pashut, right? They're pashut in the sense that they're not fooling anybody. They're not dressed for the show. And the people on the boat in the back are dressed, or one person who certainly is on that boat is certainly dressed. So. And then in the back, what do you see in the back? In the background of the picture?
Smokestacks.
What do smokestacks mean to you?
Factories?
Industry? What's factories and industry? Like good and bad, right? There's good and bad. Certainly at the time of the Industrial Revolution, everybody understood that it was good. You know, you were able to go to the city and try to get the advantages, but you also became enslaved to the revolution without being too political. But the people in the foreground, like represent a kind of escape. But maybe they work in the factories, but now they've escaped. They see something. They see something that's meaningful to them. And the something they see is not where the factories are. It's not where they came from. And on the boat don't see it. The people on the boat don't see it. So I think what we're doing is innocently trying to read this painting. Innocently meaning, I'm not telling you how somebody read it. We're just trying to read it.
Where's the beauty in the setting? Why would no one say that this is useful?
We'll say that again?
Where's the beauty in the setting? What's the intention of what seems to be clear for now? And the setting you're trying
to... Well, who made the word beauty up till now?
I'm asking. To me, art represents a certain kind of capturing of beauty and not doing it. country is like just almost an everyday kind of situation. I'm trying to make something up.
Well, so the way I look at it is, the way I look at it, it's a text. It's a text, but the difference between a written text, which kids or students sometimes have a lot of difficulty with, is that a written text, all of these pieces come out like rolls, they scroll out. And what art does is able to tell you all of these things at the same minute. And once you see it, once you see all these pieces, I don't know if beauty is here. I think timelessness is a good word. And it's a moment, you know, that the moment the artist chose it, it's hard to say that moment ever existed. He didn't have models who just sat all looking in the same direction. I mean, this, he created this. He created this instant, if it ever existed. He made it into a timeless moment for us. And that enables us to look at it, and look at it, and look at it, whereas in reality, every moment is just an instant. It passes, it's gone, it comes and goes. It's very hard. It's very hard to see moments for at all, because they all blend into each other, right? So hard for us to see what we're dealing with. And so the artist gave us a moment. He gives a moment. He says, look, in life, a person can have this, the wherewithal to look beyond wherever he is stuck, even when other people who might be fancier than he is, or more, I wouldn't say significant, but more interesting than he is on some levels, you know, don't take notice. They don't take notice of what you're able to see if you just look, if you just look hard enough. So that the notion of innocence, which I translate into be able to read the painting. And of course, I'm kidding. I don't mean that every 10-year-old kid can do this, or even that every teenager can do this. But I think it doesn't take all that much preparation. I mean, if a teacher or somebody who loves what he's looking at will be able to communicate that love and be able to convey this notion that moments, that there are moments that are of great significance. Or just a second, just an hour. You know, the Kotzker said that if you feel that you're davening with kavona, you should daven very fast, before the kavona leaves. You know, so I think what he meant is that it's definitely going to leave. Because there's only a moment, because everything changes, you know, like your constitution changes, like your stomach ache changes, your memory changes, all of a sudden something comes in that you weren't thinking about before, like you had kavana, you thought you had kavana, now you start thinking about something you have to do, right? I mean, who hasn't had that experience? Not that I've been crawling around anybody else's mind, but I imagine that everybody has that experience all the time. It's all the time, right? So there's some kind of glory to the moment. You've got to learn to savor a moment. That sometimes you go to daven, you know, and you're there for X amount of minutes, and very little of it was valuable to you. But maybe a little of it was valuable to you. A little of it was valuable to you. I was in Spassu Shabbos. I don't know how I'm telling these personal stories, but... because I don't think they're terribly meaningful. But I guess as a filler, I could tell you. So I went to Tzvaz. When I go to Tzvaz, I like to dive in a Bratzlev. There's a shul, there's a black Bratzlev community. And so I went to the boys of the yeshiva. So they always complain that the diving is too long and it's boring because all they do is diving. It's really, I find it quite amazing. You have like a room full of people who actually came to shul to daven. Now the guys at yeshiva are not so convinced that they're remarkable. I guess because they're young and optimistic. But I find this absolutely the most remarkable thing that I could ever attend. And what they do is they're committed to the fact, these people, all these people who are not great Talmidei Chachamim and they're not they're not sparkling intellect, so they're conversation is far from intriguing or exciting. They just come because they know they have to say all the davening. They have to say every single word. And that's what they all do. No one does anything else. No one does anything. So I find that quite remarkable. So in davening, what you have to look for the experience that's meaningful to you. You have to give the kids the opportunity. But what art can do, as far as I can understand, is that it can open you up to the significance of the moment, that there are things happening all the time that are of great importance. And that those, the small things that happen all the time that are of great importance, and they help you go over this chasm between unimportant and very important, which is what davening is about. Davening is like, let's stop being regular and let's do something very, very important. And I think that that art is helpful because it focuses me on, it makes a moment into something worthy of consideration. Like I can think about it. I can think about it. So this whole picture is so regular, so uninteresting, at first. But it's amazing to me that it actually captures your interest. Like what is it? What is it that's going on? What's happening? What is it that the art, what's the message of the picture? Not even of the artist. The artist that doesn't interest me particularly. Okay, now if you have a comment, don't listen to a comment. Always happy to have to listen. How do you like the picture now? It could be. I tell you, it's like everything else. Art has gone through a certain crucible. I'm not sure that all the people who study art or who write about art and all of them are great and wise people. But in some way, there's been a process of criticism where a lot of things have been pushed aside and certain things have captivated people's imagination. So again, when you look at the night watch, you look at Rembrandt's night watch, you go to Amsterdam and you say, it's very hard not to be impressed. Sometimes things are obvious, and sometimes a little bit less obvious, but I can't answer the question. I'm not enough of a connoisseur to be able to answer your question. And if somebody could do it with a photograph, I imagine that that's fine. The thing about art is that it enables the artist to create a situation that never existed, which is something that the photographer can't do. So the photographer, this is what I think, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think that the photographer can represent the beauty in nature, whereas the artist invents nature. He invents the situation. Right? Whereas the photographer doesn't invent anything. He may show it in a certain way. He may look at it from a certain side, but if there is beauty in nature or things in nature that we find very, very appealing, so the photographer can do that for us. This is the night watch, but you can't see it so well. But this is a very remarkable thing. I mean, it's another conversation, but this is a very remarkable picture. So remarkable that, after Rembrandt, no one was able to paint. It was so good that no one was able to paint after Rembrandt. All the Talmidim of Rembrandt were just able to imitate him. They just did more Rembrandt. They did an old lady, he did a group of men, they did a group of men. It was sort of like so overwhelming that it took time to break out of this Rembrandt mode. It is a very remarkable painting. But haven't got time. Let's go back to the other painting for a moment. Okay, watch down. Watch you. You see what's open. See your light. Okay. Was not how art could improve play. My topic was how art could sensitize people to their own capacity to think about things in a spiritual or more spiritual way. I don't think that you look at a painting and you go and daven. I mean, I certainly don't think that. But what I do think is that in order to daven, you need experiences. Life experiences which indicate to you that you have a certain kind of capacity that you didn't know about before you had those life experiences. Like one experience, I think, is just standing next to somebody who davens. That's a wonderful experience. But there are other kinds of experiences that might be helpful in this regard. Literature, which is like a very slow kind of way, it doesn't work so well with young people today. But literature also tends to pull apart the human experience and to show me that there is something special about it. Once I can start thinking about people and situations as being special, then maybe I can understand something about a minion. I can understand something about working together in prayer, which is certainly a difficult idea. But it's not something that you can sell frontally or halachically. That's a halacha becomes a kind of a hideout. Like instead of saying, why don't I feel like davening, everybody says, am I doing it right? Now, I think you have to do it right. I mean, I'm very conservative when it comes to things like that. However, there's no doubt that it's very limiting. Like you're sort of saying, instead of asking the right question, you keep asking the wrong question. You're saying, is it exactly 6:59, you know, Sosman Kriyashma, or what, it's 6:59 and 30 seconds? Like you can make a whole ASIC out of it, right? I think on Shabbos I told people that it's interesting that the Hasidim developed this idea that they were always on time, which was the same as saying that they don't care about time. They don't care. First, the davening, there's no time. Because whatever the reason, but the yeshiva guys, are very nervous. So you go into a yeshiva minyan in the morning. What do you make of a minyan? You know, everybody knows what time is it. You start and you finish. What time? What is so about this? What's all about that? And since this changes every day, since the exact time for all these things change daily, you can talk about them every day. So that when you, like you said, and then there are people.
I have a son, a daughter, a son-in-law, a daughter living the day after.
So you know the Shulchan Aruch, it says that when you daven Shmoneh Esrei, you should face Yerushalayim. The face of Yerushalayim said for many, many years, if you lived in Ukraine, or if you lived in Kurdistan, or if you lived in New York, facing Yerushalayim is not a problem. You either faced south, or you faced east, or you faced west, and you did it, right? And it's not a problem, because everybody knew, if you were in Russia, Yerushalayim is south. But if you live in the Veya Cove, then there's a problem. Because there's somebody in Shul who has a little machine that tells him that you can't do it north or south or east or west, but it has to be so many degrees off of south. And then you get the Kodesh Kodoshim. So then he did it. So he did it. He put up a sign of the Shul with a compass. And he showed people that, but the people didn't have their own personal compasses. They probably put the sitter, you could buy a sitter with a compass in it. You know, that's all because of this fellow who started telling people how many degrees off of north or off of south is Yerushalayim. So then what he did in this shul, in the Bay Yaakov was, the people complained. They said, well, how could it be that if I look in this way and my neighbor looks in the same way, how can we both be right? How can we both be right? And he says, obviously everybody knows that there's got to be some fraction of a difference between where he's supposed to look and where I'm supposed to look. So then he went and he printed a special map, a compass, that for every seat in the shul, you put it on the floor, and you can stand with the compass. And you know that you're facing Yerushalayim. Now this could only happen in a kind of yeshiva-oriented minyan, right? You know the Hasidish minyan. You know the Hasidim, they're running around to the mikveh, they're regular Hasidis, they run around, they think they're davening. You know, they think that when they go to the mikveh in the morning, they're already davening. It's all part of the same deal. There's no time, there's no... And so, and the Yerushalayim Hasidim stand in one place where they daven never. They don't sit in the seat, they don't stand. So they don't have any limitations of time and place. And so you have these different approaches, So I feel that you have to follow, you have to do what the halacha says. But you have to also be able to develop the capacity to ask yourself the question of whether you're actually gathering or whether you're doing something else. They're just sort of fulfilling. You know, there's a great thing. Tosfos said that no one gathers because of Or so it's like, it's a boom. It's a boom. If no one dies, we come over. So then we're all in, whatever it is, we're in, right? If no one dies, we come over. So why should I die with Kavona? Why should I feel badly about that? But Tosfos says you can't die with Kavona. So that's it. But yet, there is, you see, in modernity, there is an interest in finding ways to add a little Kavona to davening. My feeling is you have to get to sensitize a person or most people who are educated to serious kinds of thinking, ways of thinking seriously about your own capacity to have this kind of experience. And I think that art is helpful. It won't work for everybody, and it won't be good for everybody, but if it is good for somebody, it could be very helpful. Yeah. Look, maybe I won't. It's an interesting question. I mean, it could be. And I'm sure not everybody needs that. Some people can just walk up to God and die. They don't need to trip themselves into saying, I'm someplace else or I'm in a different world. They can just do it. Okay.
Okay. פרשת הרגישות הזאת, הרגישות של החיים הרעיון, כי שהפעם השתובן מרחב הזו מוגדר ומקודח לרגישויות הוגיות מסתובב, אנחנו צריכים דרך אמת מולים של אמנות, אמנות מודרנית, ולא למשל דרך תרגום של התנהגויות חסידיות, אם תפילה חסידית היא הדוגמה לתפילה הרגישה.
אין, אין כבר, זה נגמר. למשל חיקוי של חיקוי של חיקוי, אין, לא משל כלום. קרבך, אפילו בניין של קרבך זה חיקוי של חיקוי של חיקוי. אתה עובדים,
כן.
אבל
לא מסכים לזה
אלה, כן, מצפת, שאתה הולך להתפלל עם התחושות שאתה מתפלל עם דבר, לא מתרגלים את הרגישות לדבר שלנו. או, יש להם מנהיג שמלמד אותם, יש להם מנהיג שצריכים לבוא לתולון ולהגיד את דמידה. זה מה שהוא מלמד אותו. ואני, שאני לא בא בעולם כזה, זה משפיע עליי בצורה חיובית. אבל האם זה יכול להשפיע על ילדים או לא, אני לא יודע. הילדים באים לברסלב בלילה, לא באים ביום, הצעירים. ובסוף, בסוף התפילה הם רוקדים. אז כולם נהנים מהריקוד, ואני חושב שזה החלק הרלוונטי. בדרך כלל זה נחמד, זה לא... אבל לא, אבל זה לא, לא מה שקורה, אבל הילדים לא מבינים מה שקורה לדעתי, ושאף אחד לא מסביר להם. ואז ברסלב הזה גם לא יודעים מה קורה, זה ביניהם לא עושים את זה, אצלם זה טבע. אבל הנה, התפילה החסידית אין כבר, אין דבר כזה, לא יודע אם זה היה, אבל היום אין. כן.
האמירה שתרשב כדי להגיע לחוויה התכנית, אנחנו רוצים לנסות לגרות את החושים עד המקסימום. לראות את עונות הפכים בקים בעולם, לעשות את דברים חיים.
סליחה, אני לא אמרתי עד המקסימום, ואני לא... אני רק אמרתי שאם לא אומרת על זה, יש תגובה בדרך כלל. כן? בדרך כלל אנשים מושפעים מזה. לא משהו, לא נראה. סליחה.
אני חושבת של סוד בללמד ילד להגיע לחוויה רוחנית כדי שהיא לא צריכה חלק מהעניין של להגיע לתפילה בכוונה הוא להיות מסוגל להרגיש את הוואו הזה לא רק מול גרנד קניון אלא גם מול נמלה. יש שיר נהדר של לאה גולדברג ולדני אלפים ברכדית כולל על סוד עלי כמל, אני לא מתקשר על החירות ומקורות ופלות, לנשום עדיו יחל להיקשר. אני חושבת שזה האמת, זאת אומרת, להתפלל על כל פסיק ולא על הרמטורים. והנושא של אמנות הוא לדעתי, זאת אומרת, הוא משהו מאוד אישי. יש מי שהאמנות תגרום לו חוויה רוחנית, ויש מי ששירה תגרום לו חוויה רוחנית. באופן אישי, החוויות הרוחניות שלי נגרות מדברים אחרים לגמרי, ממש לא מבינות. אבל בסדר, זאת אומרת. ואני חושבת שזה מאוד אישי, ובטח חוזר לפתח רגישות, אבל צריך להיות מסוגלים להיות רגישים לעובדה שחלק מהתלמידים זה ממש לא מדברים.
עיקר הטענה היא שצריכים להתייחס לבעיה. אין ספק שקשה מאוד ללמד מה שאיננו בתוכי. וטוב מאוד ללמד מה שיש לי בתוכי. וזה אני מסכים איתך. זה לא שפה שמדבר לכולם, שאפשר להשתמש בו בצורה יעיל עם כולם. אני רק אומר, אבל בעיקר, המורים, כמורים, חייבים לפתח את היכולת העצמית למסור לתלמידים את השפה שאיתם הם יכולים לדבר על חוויות. על רגישות, על רגישות, על העולם, על תדלות העולם, או תדלות הקטן שבעולם, כפי שאת אומרת. כל זה נכון, אני מסכים. אני לא מוכר את, כן, ואני לא מוכר את השיטה. אני רק אומר, שאנחנו, אולי אני יכול לדרבן אתכם, כל אחד בנפרד, לחפש את התמצית של עצמו.
אני חושבת גם שיש גם, לא מעט אנשים שדווקא הריקוד הזה עושה לנו.
את הריקוד אחרי התפילה?
הריקוד אחרי
התפילה,
הריקוד בתוך
התפילה,
זאת אומרת, דווקא הדברים שמובעים בלידי מחול עושים להם את חווי הרוחים. אני יודע תמיד, אני רואה את הבן שלי למשל, שכשהוא מגיע למקום שרוקדים אותו כדי תפילה, הוא ממש חווה חווי הרוחים.
טוב, אני לא יכול להתייחס לבן שלי. אני חושב שיש יש חוויות פשוטות יותר ויש חוויות עילאיות, וכמחנכים אסור לנו כל הזמן לסמוך על החוויות הפשוטות. אני יודע שבמשך כך שנים, הרבה מאוד שנים, היו עקדים בישיבת הכותל, בכותל המערבי, כל נר שבת. אם זה היה חוויה רוחנית עם לב, אני לא פה בטוח. האם מישהו נהנה מזה? אולי. אבל בכל אופן, מי שלומד הרבה, ומי שברמה, רמת המשכל שלו הוא גבוה, והכמות החינוך שלו הוא עצום, והידע שלו בתורה הוא לא רגיל, נגיד, בהשוואה לאיזה חקלאי פולני. אני חושב שגם החוויות שצריכים להציע לו צריכות להיות פחות פשוטות, וחוויות שהוא יכול, שיעוררו בו גם במקומות אחרים וגם במצבים שונים את אותה הרגישות שיש לו, שהוא יכול להביא אותה לתפילה.
אני חושב שאתה מבין את זה שלו, כי מה שלכל משתמע, אני חושב שהייתה לי בתחילת, זה שאנחנו צריכים להיות מודעים לעובדה שאנחנו עוסקים עם ילדים שיש להם עולם חוויות מאוד עשיר, ולכן כדי להביא אותם לחוויה רוחנית צריך לחדש, להעצים, ואני חושבת שזה קצת, זה כמו שאומרים מסוימים, זאת אומרת, זה כאילו לגרות את החושים עוד יותר ועוד יותר ועוד יותר, זה מסוכן.
לא, אני חושב שצריך להתחלק. זאת אומרת, המורה צריך להסביר לילד מה חשוב לו, מה עוזר לו, איפה הוא רואה את גדלות,
מה חשוב
לו? אני אומר, איפה הוא רואה את גדלות הבורא בעולם? הוא צריך פשוט להתחלק בצורה אמיתית, וזה כבר צעד חשוב בכיוון הנכון. כן. טוב, אם חי נקרא כסף.
יש משהו,
אני חושב שחסר. אני מתקרב, אני אומר, שבא לתוכה, אני
מזמור את זה, בחינשי. אתה אביון לי, אתה אומר? אתה אביון לי? כן. אז אם היינו, מאות התמלת שהיו טובים, מזמור בנערות, ולשבת הפועלים, איזה יופי, באמת היה איזה קוהרנטיות, בין החוויה לבין התפילה. וכל בעצם שזו חוויה מסוימת, שזה משנה מתוקד מריחי תמונה, אמנות, סמים, דברים כאלה, כל אחד בתפילה, שוב חוזרים עוד בצורה רגילה שאין שום קשר לכאורה בין החוויה לתפילה.
בסדר, תמיד, יש תמיד דבר, אני חושב ש... כשרואים משהו בטבע שמרשים, ואז עוצרים ואומרים, אני רוצה להתפלל מנחה. אני חושב שזה כן משנה, או זה יכול לשנות. זה יכול לשנות, כן? בבני עקיבא למשל, לא בונים על זה בכלל, כן? בטבע, זאת אומרת, הפגישה של הנוער עם הטבע הוא מאוד יעיל כזה. איך אני מגיע מכאן, לעבור את הצוק הזה לשם? זה בצעה.
הם מאוד כוללנים, מה שאתה אומר. כן. אני לא תלוי איפה, אני לא יודעת את החוויה שלי מבני עקיבא, שבכל פעם שעבדנו מול נוף יפה, אז המדריך, ואחר כך אני כמדריכה לחניכה, וזה היה עומד ואומר, מה רבו מהשיחה שלי? וזה בני עקיבא שלי, זה טיולי בני עקיבא שלי, זה לא...
אני תגעת
שאתה...
כן, אני יודעת לשאול,
הוא
אמר,
הוא
אמר,
הוא
כך,
הוא הרגיש, וזה מאוד
גם שהיית דבר אחידה.
שאני
רואה
נוכיחת, זה בסדר.
אני מזכיר את החוויה שזה לא יפלוץ מעבר לאורביטה שאנחנו רוצים שיהיה
להתקבל. יש מבוגרים.
בסופו של דבר מבין מה מקור הלב. ואתה יודע, מה מופיע לי? אני לא עושה מעשה לך. אתה לא נאמר? אתה לא עושה את השאלה הבאה, אני לא יודע. מה מקור הלב.
There's two points. The article that you wrote basically seemed to imply that there needs to be an art curriculum or a place for an art curriculum in the school, and the question, one of the questions that you ask is what is it going to take place of in terms of having it, I believe.
I don't remember that.
Everything has to become a cheshbon. What I'm getting from this is you don't need an art curriculum in the school. That's not what you need, because basically art is involved. This did not do this for me personally, and I don't think as a student in high school, which I did have an art course, I don't think it would have done it for me as well. I think what you need is, based upon what you're saying, is a class in some type of opening up your eyes kind of an experience. I don't know exactly what you would call it, but basically you would have... I would say part of the class might be art to get the people who are interested in art to feel that way. Part of the issue would be music to get the people who can open that. Part of it would be to take them to Square or someplace else to see a Hasidic Rebbe daven for somebody. Part of it would be, in other words, a course based upon experiences. Of course, when you have a course based upon experiences, it somewhat cheapens the experiences that you have. Definitely there is an idea where kids are smart enough to know, well, they're giving me the experiences because they want me to experience something, and therefore I'm not going to have. That's point number one. Point number two, when a teacher sometimes, and I'm not saying this, I think a teacher should do this, I just think that there has to be a certain amount of carefulness. When a teacher gives over what they find wonder in the world, sometimes what teachers feel wonder in the world about, kids look at and basically see, this guy is crazy. And it's a little bit nuts. And depending on how, you might be telling over a story, and this happens on you might be telling over a story which is so meaningful, and like 30 kids in front of you sitting there, what is that about? You know, but what is that? So I'm just saying to you, there is this idea of telling over what makes your eyes open and the wonder in the world, but it doesn't, again, there has to be a certain amount of carefulness, and I think the problem, at least what I'm getting, is the problem is more, it's more difficult than any of the solutions that we brought up now. How exactly to do this, especially when you have kids that are basically numb, based upon Game Boys and Xboxes and television and everything else. I mean, I have kids that went to the Swiss Alps during vacation to go swim, to go skiing. I don't know what they do there. And I would say, you came back from the Swiss Alps, and they'll say, the skiing was great. And I'm like, oh, but they were the Swiss Alps. And no, but the skiing was great. Not to mention a couple other things. I just think the problem is greater than any of the solutions, and I wish there was some way to investigate more what we can do. It might be not a process of class, and it might not be one teacher. It might be somehow we have to overhaul what we're doing in second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, community education, etc., what we do with parents, and all of that put together.
I'd just like to sort of respond to what you said. The fact that this didn't move you, that's okay. But you'll have to come to 15 more lectures on this topic until you give in. So there's no doubt, as I think I said in the second part of the introduction, that we are avoiding certain responsibilities as educators. And one of those responsibilities is to clarify to the children that just because we're older than they are doesn't mean we're necessarily wrong. Especially about things about taste. Even though in the world, the teenagers, the teenage population determines taste across the board, right? They determine taste for music, for thrills, for style, for all of that. I think that and if you don't follow them, they can be very ruthless in putting you down. But I think a concerted effort has to be made to state to the children that they may not be the final arbiters of all good things. That's one thing. And the second thing is, I think it's very important that the teachers or personalities who now think of themselves as being reasonable personalities share their thoughts with the children instead of being taken in. I don't know what ex-boy is, but I think I know what gay boy is. If you go into a class and you can get the kids to convince the teacher that what he should do is try to beat the kids at some kind of a game, right, then I think you've pretty much lost. You lost that because even if the teacher knows chemistry and the students don't know chemistry, I mean, the students know it's not a big deal. I mean, they'll also know chemistry sooner or later. If you can't convince a kid, a student, that there's depth to the position of the teacher, that it should be respected, it has to be at least, that the student has to deal with it. Now that's real, that's the real thing. And you can't sort of devalue the pleasure principle a little bit, that everything is judged by whether you have a good time or not. So I think that those are really overwhelming problems.
But I think that the greater discussion in terms of the teacher presence in a classroom has to do certainly, definitely with his perception of himself, his or her perception of himself, etc. But I think I just had a discussion with a group of students today about it, and part of it is the way that the community reacts to teachers. Meaning, it's very hard to convince, well, it's not so hard, but in many cases it is a difficulty to convince students of the depth of the teacher when basically all they hear when they get home is something about the rabbi of the shul, teacher, and I think that while dealing with the teacher himself, how he perceives himself when he walks into that classroom, because I think a lot of it is, as one rabbi when I first started teaching told me, this is your classroom, you're the king of your classroom. This is, you have to have that self-esteem when you walk into the classroom. On the other hand, it has to be worked with the community, which I've discussed many, many times, about the way that the community, the Jewish community as a whole, treats its faculty, treats its teachers. And I think that has to go hand in hand.
Well, I have to understand that in Israel it's worse, because there's also the Misrad HaChinuch, which is an invention that no one ever could have imagined. You're right, David, but there are things you can do against that. I think there are things you can do to deal with that problem. It's a problem. It's true that there's a pecking order of lack of respect for people who only know how to teach. And that, but after all, people who only know how to teach are basically failures who weren't able to do the real stuff and make that much money. So they're only able to make this much money. And that entirely dependent on the whim of the next chairman of the board, who probably knows a lot about education. Right? So everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. The problem is, of course, who's the problem? Is the problem the people who create that problem, or the people who put up with it? I don't know. I think the people who put up with it could act to create a different reality. And once they create that different reality, they're going to have to teach the kids about art. Okay. Look, if you don't like art, I mean, to start with Rothko would be very difficult. Yes?
Nature, I hear that because, the designer of nature is in charge. The designer of art is some locally or some bigger locally or smaller locally. I'm not sure that speaks to kids.
speak to kids is what the kid speaks to kids is what I want to talk about.
Right.
That's what speaks to kids. If you tell me I can't use these words because they don't know what they mean, I've used different words, I'll do that. But what speaks to children, what speaks to the kids, is what I want to talk about. They don't have a say.
That's true.
I'm very much into that. And that's why I'm not a teacher.
If you want to develop a certain amount, if the goal of this enterprise is to develop that wow feeling on some level.
Show people that they have the capacity to have that feeling more often, more regularly. It's more part of them than they might have thought.
Right. So I'm saying that I think that if you want to engender that kind of feeling in a student, you want to allow them to begin to believe and then see within themselves that they have that ability. To do that while they're looking at something that was designed and created by a being for whom they want to have a certain greater level of respect than or whoever designed some picture that anybody can give any sort of meaning to. In other words, the same way we've been talking about triangles, somebody else is going to see rectangles, and somebody else is going to see circles, is in my mind much more difficult.
It's been under my analysis.
Pardon?
My analysis has been undermined by rectangles and circles. Can I say this? I understand your, I think that, that one of the things about modern orthodoxy that I find compelling, as opposed to what other people say about modern orthodoxy, none of which I find compelling at all, because I don't think modern orthodoxy is interested in Israel, and Eretz Israel particularly. I don't think they are particularly interested in women learning Torah, just except when they're forced to. What's the third thing about modern orthodoxy? Eretz Israel, women. Oh, general studies. Yeah, going to college. No, they go to college. They get a profession. The thing that I think could be compelling about modern orthodoxy is that they have a respect for the human endeavor. That they recognize the fact that man created in celibate/woman, right, is meaningful. In that they can produce something meaningful. That's what Tzelem means. Otherwise, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? I think that modern people who've had the benefit of education are able to say, I can judge the result of the human enterprise. Without always getting into the question of what kind of person was he, how did he live, and what did he do, and was he nice to his neighbors, and you know, all of this kind of stuff. It's true, I agree that to be a Gadol b'Torah, you have to be a great person. There's some kind of a correspondence. To be a Gadol result of what the people did is wondrous. It is a wondrous world that we live in. But not only the mountains are wondrous, but the cities are wondrous, the setup is wondrous. It's not good, perfect, or anything like that. It's just wondrous. I mean, could anyone have thought about this hundreds of years ago? You know what we have? So I think that modern orthodoxy, I think they have the capacity, or should have the capacity, to recognize the wondrous nature of human achievement, which is not the same as saying, I would like to be like Benjamin Franklin. I don't want to be like Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was, to my mind, like not of what was of high moral standards, or Thomas Jefferson. I don't like Thomas Jefferson. He wrote a great declaration. But he was not, but he was a slave owner. I don't think being a slave owner is a great thing. So I can handle that. I mean, can't say like Thomas Jefferson did a great thing, and he might have been wrong about a few other things, or anybody. I mean, what's the problem? But the human endeavor is significant, that we wear these fluorescent lights. Don't you think that's great? No?
I do, but I think there's a difference between seeing things that human beings have done and saying that's great, it's utilitarian, it's valuable, and that's going to be the thing that's going to help me develop my own.
Well, no, I didn't say that. What I said was that the human enterprise is noteworthy. It's worthy of noticing. And so while it's true that not only the people who painted these paintings are people that I'd like to have my students emulate, nevertheless, the result of the human enterprise may be of significance. Look, it's very easy. People take, well, like music. Music is easy. It goes easy with four people because there are no people there, and there are no words, and there are no pictures, and there are no nothing. So, but a lot of the people who wrote music were not great. So was somebody going to stop listening to Mozart because he didn't like Mozart? I mean, I can't even imagine. Stop listening to Beethoven because he didn't like the way he treated his wife or something. Right, this is a political thing, you know, in Israel. They never existed any flaw. Jews always listen to Wagner. What Jews did listen to Wagner. It's only in Israel that they figured out this idea. That there are plenty of bad people in the world, but Wagner was a bad poet, was worse than anybody else. What's the worst thing? Talented, great people are not always good people.
System where I appreciate what the person did, even though that they're an awful person, setting up a way where a kid will understand, well, if I accomplish something great, I'm not saying this is
I think there's great danger of my character. There's great danger of being part of the world, as any square chassid will tell you. And there's no doubt that there's a certain number of modern Orthodox Jews, young, like my age and younger, who thought that becoming the square chassid is the way to go. Because they couldn't figure out this question. Anyway, what about watching baseball games? And basketball games? You know those basketball players? They're salt of the earth, right? The cream of human existence, those guys. Will Chamberlain. I mean, I know I'm a little dated, right? But I'm thinking more of what he said than what he did. I mean, what are we talking about? So far, I agree it's dangerous, but that's not called modern. Modern means that you can get the good. It's like, you know, what Mayer? Yeah, but this is not, we're not talking about happy courses, we're just talking about... I know it's Chochmah Bagoyim, it's quality, but it's something real, there's something there that's worthy. Is it dangerous? Could it be attractive? Yeah, I think so. You think that all the Israeli kids go to India? You think that could be dangerous? Yeah, it could be dangerous. Anything could be. That's the price. That's the price you pay. That's the price you pay. And then what you're supposed to do is build up the students, educate them to be able to put up with it. So now, what do you think? What do you think you need to put up with modernity? So, okay, maybe you're not payers. Boys are payers. No. So then they won't get into trouble. Like devil, I'm mad at the census. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's a problem. But if you think modernity has advantages, and if you think that listening to music, reading a book, studying science, knowing just to know about what's going on has some value in terms of creating a world view, and that's not contradictory to Torah, then I agree, you're taking a chance. You are taking a chance. I mean, everybody's taking a chance. Life is, you know, even in Mei Sharm, you know, they walk around. So sometimes they get to Kikar Shabbat. The people who wear that kind of clothes, when they get to Kikar Shabbat, they're the minority, right? They start at Mei Sharm, they're the majority. They get to Kikar Shabbat, so they're the minority. And that's a real problem for them. It's a real problem. You know, they're going around closing the falafel stands in Gula at night because they had people from Mei Sharm walking one block. They get a falafel, where, you know, where the situation was different. The Gula is the enemy. The Gula is the enemy of Mei Sharm. So I agree, I mean, I understand that. We all understand that. But if you think
if you think that it's worth something, so you have to take a chance. And you have to try to teach kids that the religious experience is there for them. If they will just, you know, try to get it. All the best, Rabbi Sacks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
I have to leave a few minutes over. If you're in the National Gallery in London, go and see this painting. I'm sure you'll like it. Okay. Rabbi Sacks, I will talk to you tomorrow.